sort of branches of your aortic arch. So the first branch of the aortic arch is your right denominate artery, or we sometimes call it the brachiocephalic trunk. It subdivides into your right common carotid and the right subclavian artery. The subclavian artery gives rise to your vertebral artery, which we'll take a background today. The next branch over is the left common carotid artery. This is a direct branch of your aortic arch. And then the third one is the left subclavian artery, from which your left vertebral artery comes from. As anything in the human anatomy, this is only true for in about 70% of cases, and you would see a whole lot of variations. One of the common variants is that the left common carotid artery that you see as the second branch would also rise from your brachiocephalic artery or innominate artery, which could create potential problems in certain patients. So the common carotid artery is located anterolaterally in the neck and medial to the jugular vein. It is right here, as I pointed. The carotid artery, the jugular vein, and your vagus nerve are enclosed in a connective tissue, as you know, called the carotid sheath. The artery terminates as two terminal branches, the internal carotid artery, right here, and your external carotid artery. This bifurcation usually happens at the, this is a common board exam question, at the superior border of your thyroid cartilage at about the level of your fourth cervical vertebra. And again, variations, the bifurcation could be as low as T2, could be as high as T1. So, but in general, superior border of your thyroid cartilage. The external carotid artery is the smaller of the these two branches. How do we know, if you're just looking at arteries in the neck, how do you know which is what? The answer is that external carotid have branches in the neck, internal carotid would have none. So if it has branches, it's external. It has eight branches that I listed down here, the first of which would be the superior thyroidal artery. Again, this is a board exam question. And these branches are very important because their abundant number actually provides the ability to build up collateral circulation. So your external branches basically connects with the intracranial circulation via scalp perforators to actually provide cerebral blood flow in cases of carotid artery occlusion. So do not ignore your external carotid artery. The internal carotid artery is the larger of the two branches. It's divided into four main segments. For this talk, we're going to concentrate on the cervical branch, which begins at the level of the bifurcation to the point just before the carotid perforates in the base of the skull. Remember that you have what we call the carotid bulb, which is the dilatation right at the beginning of your carotid artery. Again, no branches in the neck. When it gets into your temporal bone, it's called the Petrus segment, and then it goes into your cavernous sinus. It actually is invested within the sinus itself. This is your cavernous sinus, your carotid artery. The yellow ones are cranial nerves, and you now won't wonder why, when you have conditions like aneurysms or cavernous aneurysms of the carotid artery, you actually get cranial neuropathies as well. And the cerebral branch begins after the artery perforates the dura mater. It passes between the optic and the oculomotor nerves and then proceeds to its terminal bifurcation into your MCA and ACA. The carotid artery is a big player in the formation of your circle of Willis. It's actually formed from branches from paired carotid and vertebral.
Down here.
It's actually a very uniquely laid out architecture, so it actually is very protective of your cerebral blood flow. So that in cases where, for example, you block or you have hypoplasia or occlusion of your ACA, you could still get blood flow in that area from collaterals from the other side. So this is a way of ensuring adequate cerebral blood flow. Now, what do we know about the carotid artery disease? Remember that your artery would have three layers, your adventitia, your intima, and your media. And carotid disease is mostly due to atherosclerosis, which is due to buildup of cholesterol and fibrotic tissue in your arterial wall. They result from both genetic and environmental influences. Why we don't see a whole lot of them in Jacobi, Caucasians are actually more prone to cervical carotid disease, while the ethnic minorities, which are most of our patients, are more prone to intracranial atherosclerotic disease. There are other uncommon causes that you may or may not see during your residency, which includes dissection, vasculitis, and fibromuscular dysplasia, among others. Now, how do you evaluate a patient who has a putative carotid artery disease? So a lot of times they come to you with some degree of vascular event, right? And sometimes not, and you just order it, you know, as an afterthought. So what useful information would you need in your history? Vascular risk factor is very important. The typical profile would be a Caucasian smoker. They would have lots of carotid artery problems. If they present with focal neurologic deficits, that's very good to know. Or sometimes you don't ask this. Episodes of transient monocular blindness, or if restricted to a vascular cause, we sometimes call it amaurosis fugax. And I would take any obscuration of vision, not just the typical, you know, drawing of the curtains, etc. Very unlikely to be related to things like syncope. You have to cut off circulation of both your carotid arteries to make somebody syncopize. Very rarely headache or pain. And I put in the exception of dissection, because sometimes they present to you with pain. However, in my short experience as a neurologist, this pain that presents with dissection are non-disabling. Usually they're achiness or almost like a tired feeling in the neck, not really an excruciating pain that would have you run to the hospital. Now, how about a physical examination? You have to do everything else, but in terms of carotid artery, the classic recommendation is the assessment of the presence of the carotid bruit, which I would like you to continue to do while you're residents and also when you're physicians. But there have been questions as to the validity of it. So one of the questions is that if I hear a bruit, does that tell me that my patient has significant stenosis? And if I don't, does that reassure me that my patient has no problem? Will the presence of a bruit change what am I to do with a patient? So they actually looked at this question, people who didn't really have too much to do in life. And they actually found that hemodynamically significant lesions or stenosis of the carotid artery may exist in the absence of an audible bruit. So if you're suspicious, I think you should remain suspicious whether or not you hear a bruit. And the absence of a bruit may also signify that you really have an occluded carotid artery. No flow, no sounds coming from it. So for clinically significant stenosis, the sensitivity of carotid bruit is only 63 to 76%. Specificity is 61 to 76%. And if you have taken care of a number of vascular patients, you would actually know that irrespective of whether you get carotid artery bruit or not, I think it's good practice to still send them for vascular risk assessment. Now, we imaged them after getting physical examination and their history, and there are 4 studies available to us currently. So the first would be the carotid duplex. I like it. It's non-invasive, virtually without complications. If you've been in Jacobi long enough, you actually know that it's quick to do, quick to get, readily available. If you compare it to an angiogram, a digital subtraction angiogram, which is the gold standard of all the tests, the sensitivity is about 70%, so pretty good. Now, in most places, and in Jacobi as well, we can also do CT angiograms. So this is nothing but a CT scan of your neck with particular attention to your carotid artery. What they do is they actually get very, very thin slices or sections of the neck and then reformat it so that you can get the anatomy of your artery. It has very good resolution. I actually like it better than an MRA, but you have to have some degree of expertise to interpret it. Also readily available and quick to do if you're friends with a CT techs and supervisor. And the only caveat to it is that you have complications associated with giving patients IV dye. So if you have a renal patient or patients with iffy renal disease, you may have to think twice about doing this. MR angiogram, on the other hand, also has good resolution and again requires expertise in interpretation. It is technically readily available with the exception of Jacobi, and relatively quick to do. One of the difficulty is that we have the machine is designed to be claustrophobia inducing. I didn't know if all of you have seen it. So it's like a tunnel, and while you're inside, it has this loud banging noises, and you have to have the patient lie still for about 20 to 30 minutes. So the more studies you attach to an MRI, the longer it would take. So if you order an MRI, MRA of the brain, and MRA of the neck, that would be an hour inside a machine, so a very long time. So you have to lie in an immovable, non-moving state for about an hour. I'm not sure that I can do that. The digital subtraction and angiogram is the gold standard. As you know, it's invasive. You also have complications related to the IV dye. And the procedure itself has a 1% peri-procedural stroke risk. So it's not without complications. Now, let me actually go over the different tests with you. So, carotid duplex ultrasound, you all know how they perform it. The degree of stenosis is actually determined by the velocity of blood flow through the artery. So if you go back to your physics, it follows that the smaller the lumen, the higher the velocity of flow through it. And it follows that the higher the velocity, the greater the degree of stenosis of the carotid artery. So this is a picture of your carotid artery, and these are the waveforms that they actually get. This is systolic, peak systolic, and this is end diastolic velocity. Now, it's actually very fancy, you know, like your 2D echo. It can actually demonstrate the area of stenosis by flow. There's also a mode called B mode that can actually show you the anatomy of the carotid artery. So sometimes you find results of duplexes telling you, oh, you know, you have a homogeneous plaque or a plaque of this characteristic that's prone to rupture. So this is actually how they come about telling us that. It can identify other pathology as well. So this picture is an example of a dissection. So in artery dissection, you develop a false lumen. So this is the true lumen of the carotid artery. It has narrowed down. This is what it was in. And you actually have this false channel where you see some flow as well. So it can diagnose that too. Now, how do they come about with interpreting or telling us what there is? So this is of a real patient. So they actually we actually sent her for karate duplex. It says here that she had a history of a right ISA and arthrectomy, and because of a high-grade stenosis, 80 to 99%. So basically, they tell you that in the right, she's okay, and in the left, they believe that she has an 80 to 99% stenosis. So how do they figure that out, right? So this is the report that comes along with this interpretation. And I think when you're evaluating your patients to figure out who to send for procedures or further testing, you have to know how to go about this. I think 80 to 99% stenosis is not the problem, it's actually the moderate grade stenosis. So I'm going to tell you the trade secret. So they're going to report to you, this is right, this is left. They report to you CCA and ICA velocities. The numerator would be your peak systolic velocity. The denominator would be your end diastolic velocity. So this is right and this is left. So I'm going to go back to this slide and I'm going to tell you how it's done. So for you to know, you basically remember three numbers, 125, 140, and 4. So if you actually have a peak systolic velocity of less than 125, that's a non-significant stenosis, less than 50%. If you're over 125, they say 50 to 79% stenosis. And if you have an end-diastolic volume of 140, you even have a higher grade stenosis, which is 80 to 99% stenosis. Now, remember that the magic number for end arthrectomy is 70%, so we want to know who amongst the 50 to 79% people have more than 70% stenosis. You look at the ICA-CCA ratio. Obviously, when you have an occluded artery, you do not have any flow through it. So let's actually go back. In this patient, right side, peak systolic velocity is 123. So not a problem, less than 50% stenosis. Now if you go to the left side, peak systolic velocity is 470. So that's over 125. You know that there's significant stenosis. And if you look at the end diastolic velocity, it's 155. So that's how they came up with their report of 80 to 99% stenosis. Now, for those who have more than 70, this ICA-CCA ratio is also greater than 4. So we're pretty certain that she has pretty high grade stenosis. Any questions? So in addition, they would also tell you other important information, the extent of your plaque, other plaque rest characteristics, and sometimes they actually tell you if the distal carotid artery has some degree of occlusion of if they're truly patent. So they're going to manifest as high resistance or resistance in the blood flow if you have a stenosis further down. Okay. Now this is a CT angiogram. I want you to look at the numbers and I want you to see that compared to a digital subtraction angiogram, it actually, when they compared the two, they were in agreement in 96% of cases. The sensitivity, meaning if you have a stenosis, it's able to pick it up, is 100%. And more importantly, the inter-observer agreement, if you get 10 people to interpret the CTA, you actually have more people agreeing to the result than compared to digital subtraction angiograms. So this is actually a very nifty, easy-to-do procedure. In fact, a number of radiologists like this better than an angiogram because they have the ability to look at the artery in 3D images as compared to digital subtraction angiogram that are 2D images. So when they reformat it, if they're inspired and they want to do that, to do their reformatting, this is the picture that you're supposed to see. So you can see your CCA, your ECA. Remember, it has branches in the neck. And this is your ICA with that much of stenosis. So you can literally see that this artery needs fixing. Well, what do we get in Jacobi? We get these images. So this is actually a patient who came in with a non-dominant hemispheric stroke. And while he was getting PPA, we ended up getting a CTA for him to see whether he has any blockage of the artery anywhere. And if you look at these images, I want you to pay attention to this. This is your jugular vein, your internal carotid artery, and your external carotid artery. Remember, bigger, smaller. Now you go to the right side, which is the side of interest. You have your vein, you have your external, no internal carotid artery. A couple of days after we gave him TPA, this is actually the follow-up scan, external in jugular, and if you see here, there's a reconstitution of a very, very small lumen. So that's the residual lumen, almost like a string sign. Very important to know, because this patient, as long as it's not occluded yet, will be a candidate for endarterectomy and will have good response to it. No, you need a tech, and somebody would give the IV dye. That's actually the beauty of it. You don't need a radiologist. It's like getting a CT of the abdomen with contrast. The same procedure, only they're getting images of your neck. Amarangiogram, very, very good study for high-grade stenosis and ICA occlusion. A tad bit questionable in terms of moderate stenosis. So the sensitivity is only about 38%, specificity 92%. And we actually get it two ways. You can get it without contrast, so it's actually a flow-based study. What they do is when they get the images, they only get the ascending flow. That's why you only get your artery. When you get an MRV, they actually get the reverse flow, the descending flow. So that's what you call time of flight if it's flow-based. And if you want to increase the index of picking up something, you actually do a contrast-enhanced MRA. So this is how an MRA looks like. Again, it can show you significant carotid stenosis if it's present. This is of the patient who's carotid duplex I showed you. This is her right side. Remember, the duplex said no significant stenosis after endarterectomy. And you can see a beautiful internal carotid artery. Right here in the left side, remember they said 80 to 99% stenosis, so they agree. The MRI and the carotid duplex agree. So in practice, when we have two studies and they agree, we kind of feel comfortable that they're all saying the truth. And digital subtraction angiogram pretty much shows you similar pictures. You can actually get a picture of your stenosis here. Sometimes it could be this moderate grade stenosis as well. Now what do we do after we find out? So the treatment strategy, the first treatment strategy, and I'm very particular about this, is prevention. You really would like for the patient not to have a problem rather than fix the problem when it comes, because sometimes the problem itself would be difficult to fix. So you stabilize or halt the progression of a carotid plaque so that it will not progress to a degree where it causes a problem or you need to intervene. Simple, you help patients control their risk factors. I guess simpler to say than to do. Attention, these are the recommended targets by the American Heart Association. Diabetes, we all know this. Elevated lipid panels, especially your LDL. In patients who have had vascular events, remember that they want you to drop down the LDL to less than 70 if possible. Cigarette smoking, have them stop. Alcohol use, eliminate excessive use. And there's recommendation for increased physical activity. You got 30 to 60 minutes of exercise in most days, or at least 3 days a week. All of us fail in this aspect. Treatment strategy number two is to eliminate or reduce carotid stenosis. In general, all patients should receive an antiplatelet agent, and we can talk later on which agent to fix. Anticoagulation therapy is not routinely recommended, although there are several patients with special circumstances that calls for the use of IV heparin and sometimes Coumadin for a short period of time, but not perpetually. Endovascular surgery, endovascular therapy, I will tell you a little bit more about later on. Carotid end arterectomy, I will also tell you in greater detail. So, carotid end arterectomy is your treatment of choice, gold standard of treatment. We are hearing about a lot of push for the use of endovascular techniques similar to what we use in cardiology, which is angioplasty and stenting. The trials in case series have shown that the use of stents would be a little bit worse than or no different than when you do end arterectomy in patients. So right now, the use of angioplasty and stenting for your carotid artery is limited to patients with high surgical risk. So those patients that you cannot clear for anesthesia would have to actually go for carotid stenting or angioplasty or a combination of both. Now, long before you were born, or most of you were born, they actually tested a procedure called ECIC bypass. So this was intended for people with occlusion. And that was a negative study, non-beneficial. Although they're revisiting the same study, there's a study going on called Carotid Occlusion Surgery Study. They're trying to couple together the old-time procedure of ECIC bypass, but increasing the chances that this procedure will be effective by using new imaging technology. So they're actually doing PET scans in people with carotid occlusion. So the thought process was that a lot of people failed before because they operated on people who may not have needed to be operated on, so people with very robust collateral circulation. Remember, you can get it from external sources or from branches of your circle of Willis. So they're looking at the oxygen extraction fraction. So if they actually have adequate circulation, they don't touch them anymore. If they feel that there is not an adequate collateral circulation formed yet, then they randomize them to get the procedure. So this is an ongoing study. Symptomatic carotid stenosis, there are a number of studies that visited this problem. So for more than 70% stenosis, again, symptomatic, people with strokes, TIAs, or amaurosis fugax, the two-year rate of ipsilateral stroke was found to be 26% in those treated medically and 9% in the surgical group. I don't like these numbers, but I think I would like to know this. This is number needed to treat. That means you need to send only 7 to 8 patients for end arterectomy to prevent one stroke in a 5-year period. So that's very few patients. So this is a very, very effective procedure. Less than 50% stenosis, no benefit from surgery. So don't even send them to anyone. And so we actually do optimal medical management in these people. The difficulty in making a decision lies in those with moderate grade stenosis. So these are the gray people, I call them. So In the European study, they actually showed that there was no benefit in doing surgery in these people, but in the US side study, they actually found that surgery could be somewhat beneficial, but the number needed to treat is actually double. So instead of 7 to 8, you send 15 patients for end arterectomy. Well, what will guide you in picking the patient descends. So they actually they actually found certain characteristics. So you have a greatest benefit for end arterectomy. That means you have a higher risk of stroke, thereby you benefit from surgery if you have more severe stenosis, meaning if you're 65 rather than 55. So you actually may want to send these patients. If they're 75 years of age and older, men more than women, if you have had a recent event within 3 months rather than 9 months or 12 months ago, if you had cerebral TIA, meaning numbness, aphasia, or weakness compared to just amaurosis fugax or transient monocular blindness, and certain radiographic factors, if you have intracranial stenosis, absence of microvascular ischemia, and presence of collateral vessels. So this actually makes the surgery safer for you. You have to look at the operative risk. If you can't clear them for surgery, you might as well not perform the surgery. And this is actually very controversial, the experience of the surgeon operating on them. Technically, we're supposed to have statistics in our hands, but I haven't really seen an institution where this is common knowledge. You have to know who you're working with. For asymptomatic carotid stenosis, the risk of stroke obviously is lower than when you have symptomatic disease. They actually found that the stroke risk was about 1 to 3% per year for those with stenosis of over 50%. Now, they actually looked at asymptomatic carotid disease specifically, and they actually found that the risk of ipsilateral stroke or any perioperative stroke was about 5% during 5 years of follow-up. So the number needed to treat is about 17. So because you have a lower absolute risk reduction, when you have higher perioperative risk, so if you have a high-risk patient or a high-risk surgeon or a combination of both, it's easier to actually negate any benefit that you can actually get from doing the surgery. So you really have to think about the risk-benefit ratio more in these people. And to outline, the benefit of surgery was greater for men than for women, and the rate of perioperative complications was also higher among women than in men. So this information actually comes from a paper written by Dr. Sacco in New England Journal from October of 2001. And I actually like this very practical algorithm that I'd like to share with you. So when you're presented with extracranial carotid stenosis, the first thing you need to ask yourself, do I say this patient is symptomatic or asymptomatic? So you have to sometimes ask detailed questions to get your answer. If you're symptomatic, you can subdivide patients into mild, moderate, severe, mild, optimum medical management, severe, and arterectomy unless you have very, very severe contraindications. Moderate stenosis, you have to think a little bit harder. You actually have factors that actually tells you the patients that have low risk of carotid stroke, thereby you can and factors that would tell you my patient will have a higher risk of carotid-related stroke, so you send them for end arterectomy anyway. For asymptomatic stenosis, the magic number is 60% stenosis. If it's over 60 and you have a good patient, a good surgeon, and you can assure that the surgical risk is low, then it may be beneficial for them to be sent for end arterectomy. If you do not have any of this insurance factors, then you're better off doing medical therapy in your patients. So these are very good guidelines and almost like a checklist for you when you're making recommendations for your patients. I'm going to skip this. So I'm going to just show you a few cases. This is actually the lady who I whose duplex and MRA I showed you. This is she's about 57 years old, Caucasian, diabetic, hypertensive, obese. In 2008, she presented with an episode of vertigo, and this were her studies. MRI, these are FLIR images. Any abnormality would be white. You have your MRA and your extracranial MRA. So what do you think? Would you call this patient symptomatic, asymptomatic? Came in with vertigo. My resident actually said that he felt the vertigo is peripheral in nature. Symptomatic, asymptomatic. Who says symptomatic? Who says asymptomatic? So when you think vertigo, what circulation do you think about? Substeria. So a lot of times when you talk about, you know, we're quick to say vertigo, vertebrobasilar insufficiency. You have to remember vertigo caused by insufficiency, vascular insufficiency, will always come with some other things that's brainstem in flavor. Cranial nerve dysfunction, maybe hearing loss, etc. Okay, so we actually thought she was asymptomatic, but we worked her up. This was her MRI, good, bad, ambivalent. Who says good? Who says bad? Who has no opinion? So this is a good brain. You, abnormality would be white. This is whistle clean. I would want a brain like that when I grow older. Intracranial circulation, I hope you can see it from where you're sitting. Pretty decent as well. Extracranial, remember, Caucasian smoker. Left side, right side. So left side has some disease. Is it critical? Not really. Right side has some disease. Is it critical? Yes, you actually have a gap over there. So this was 82-99% stenosis. So at this point, we ended up sending her for the procedure, and she did very well. And you actually saw the follow-up study when the artery has been repaired with carotid endarterectomy. And then she came back earlier this year, again with an episode of vertigo. Again, peripheral in nature. So we'll go over asymptomatic, or symptomatic. You can argue. We looked at her brain. Nothing has happened in a two-year period. Again, whistle clean. Intracranial circulation, still pristine. This is the right side which they operated on. It actually held up okay. And now, remember, if you don't change your habits and you don't control your risk factors, disease will get worse. So this is, you can see the natural progression of carotid stenosis. So what was moderate grade a couple of years ago is now high grade, 80-99% stenosis. So she did go for surgery again, and again did very well. So she has now repairs of both ICNs. So this is a young woman. I believe she was in her late 40s when I saw her. She has every risk factor, every vascular risk factor you can imagine. In addition, she has polysubstance abuse, chain smoker. Everybody in her house smokes as well, so she has first-hand smoke, second-hand smoke, all kinds of smoke. She uses drugs as well and drinks quite a bit. She came in with a COPD exacerbation, as you can imagine, was intubated, and we were called because after they took her off sedation and was planning to extubate her, they realized that she wasn't moving the right side very well. So this is her MRI long after the procedure. So this is the left frontal stroke that she sustained. And this is her MRA. What do you think? Is it normal, abnormal? Is it abnormal? What's abnormal? There's no carotid artery. So this is your carotid artery, MCA, ACA, your basilar vertebrals, no ICA in the left side. But what can you say about her circulation? She's good collateral flow, right? She has the MCA, in spite of the lack of an ICA, is being perfused well, and the ACA as well. So she has blessed herself with collateral flow. This is her MRA, right side. What do you say? This is your vertebral artery. This is your ECA, that's the superior thyroidal artery. And this is your ICA. This is your left side. You have the occlusion stump. You have a stump. It's almost like when you cut the tree, you're left with a stump. This is the carotid stump from where it was occluded. Now, I showed you this because there's actually this phenomenon of false elevation of your velocities when you send people for carotid end artery, carotid Doppler. So when one side is occluded because the other side makes up for collateral circulation, they would actually have increased flow. And since your duplex is flow-based, when they make their interpretation, they will report to you that this patient will have higher grade stenosis than what she really has. So for this particular patient, when I follow her up, I get an anatomical picture. So I usually send an MRA and not a carotid duplex. So no matter how many times you repeat the carotid duplex, it would still be elevated. So she doesn't have significant stenosis. Unfortunately, she hasn't changed her waist. I'm sure you're all familiar with her if I tell you her name. This is a young woman, all of 47 years old. We met her when she was sent to the emergency department from the outpatient clinic, where she presented with hypertensive urgency. I think her blood pressure was systolic 220. So she was sent there for treatment and was being triaged by the nurse in the ED when all of a sudden, for a minute or two, she couldn't answer the questions well, and the nurse felt that she wasn't actually moving her right side. All of 2 minutes, by the time they called us and we came down, she's completely back to normal. Completely normal neurologic exam. When we worked her up, because that's aphasia and right-sided weakness, it could be a TIA. But when we worked her up, she had a small lesion in the left frontal lobe, which was acute, telling you that she did have a stroke, only it wasn't big enough to cause lasting deficits. This is her MRA, completely good. And this doesn't really translate very well, but she's actually one with moderate grade stenosis. She's more towards 50%, so the decision was actually to hold off treating her. This was 6 years ago almost, and she has remained asymptomatic today. So you don't necessarily have to do arthrectomy. You actually have to think about every single patient, the risks involved when you send them for surgery, and the benefits that they will obtain when they get the surgery. So I'm going to end here if you have any questions. I gave you a whole lot.